All right, so we're continuing with Rav Volbi's Ma'amar Yemei Ratzon. As I mentioned last time a few times, it is written anonymously, but we know exactly who wrote it. And we are continuing in the year Tavshin, what was it? Tavshin Lamed Zayin to Tavshin Lamed Chet. So Elo Tavshin Lamed Zayin. And as I said last time, he goes according to, you know, he gave a few different shmuzin each week. And last time we ended talking about the idea of a nekudat ha'emet, that everybody learning Torah should be looking to find a kernel of truth in every piece of Torah that they're learning, no matter how simple or how complex it might be. But now we arrive at the eponymous Kadosh Baruch Hu Rachok V'Karov. This is where the name of the theme comes from. The theme is called L'Karov L'Rachok. You know, just to recap, we actually already mentioned the theme of Rachok when he started by talking about Tisha B'Av as a Mo'ed of Richuk. And he talked about how sometimes Richuk can be a good thing, or at least it can be a meaningful thing. Because if you feel distant from God, it means that at least you feel some kind of proximity, you feel some kind of distance from him, which means that you're thinking about him. And the worst thing is to not think about him at all. Okay, so now he strikes a philosophical tone in this chapter. This is Shabbat of Parshat Shoftim. And he starts by saying, it's not very poetic, sometimes he can be very poetic. He says, Anu potchim ha'inayim roim nof, anu shomim medabrim rash mechoniot. Well, we look out in the world and we see all kinds of physical things. We hear physical things. We touch physical things. Anu ta'amim ta'amim shonim. We taste different things. Mialdut anu regidim ba'olam gashmish anu mabchinim bo b'kol chusheinu. We're used to a physical world that appeals to our senses. Kasher lanu ma'od l'ta'er l'atzmeinu sheyeshna metziyut she'i yasha l'avchin ba b'chushim ruchniut. It's very difficult for us to relate at all, or to understand, or to even believe in an aspect of the world which we can't see, reach out and touch, feel, hear, understand through our senses. But he says, this is the third of the Ikarim, that God does not have a body. But it's very hard for us to understand that. And he quotes the Rambam. The Rambam says, how do we know that God doesn't have a body? This is interesting. It's kind of a trivial proof. It says, because the Torah says, Hashem Elokeichem hu Elokim b'shamayim mima'al v'al ha'aretz mitachat. He's God in the sky, and he's also God below on the earth. And he says, but a body can't be in two different places. So how could it be God above and also God below? It must be that he has no body. That's the proof that he quotes from the Rambam in Hilchot Yisod Torah. Okay, obviously the Rambam has more in his arsenal than that. But that's one proof based on a biblical verse. Now he continues and he points out the Rambam is very machmir on this. The Rambam, of course, is, you know, the one who's most well known for coming out against the corporeality of God, the idea that God has a body, as we mentioned last time. He says this is one of the five kinds of heretics is a person who believes that God has a body. When the Rambam writes this, the Ravid actually comments on it. The Ravid writes, he says, you know, you're going to call this person an apikoros. He says, many gedolei olam, people who are as wise and as learned as the Rambam, believe that God had a body. This is actually a fascinating period in history where this was still up for debate. You know, for us, it's unfathomable. To us, it's clear that God doesn't have a body. But there was a time, Eitzel HaRishonim, where there were people who legitimately believed that God had body parts. Now, why would they believe that?
Because the Torah refers to God and his body.
Exactly, because the Torah refers to God and his body parts and refers to God having emotions and physical attributes, hands and feet, and a nose, and he gets angry, and he feels love and hate and all those kinds of things, which the Rambam is merachik. He pushes those away. He tries to make them mean not what they normally mean. But for a Rishon to say that, you know, God has a hand. Now, what does a hand look like? I don't know. But that he has a hand, none other than Rashi actually seems to write this. Rashi writes in one place where it says Yad, he says Yad Mamash. Now, take that as you might, you know, don't know necessarily what Rashi means, but it certainly sounds like Rashi's saying that there is a hand. Either way, the Ravid writes that there were Balei Tosfot who actually believed that God had a body, so he has a big problem with the Rambam saying that you could be an Apikoros for believing such a thing. You may be wrong. The Ravid didn't disagree with the Rambam that God didn't have a body, but to be an Apikoros because of such a thing was not so appealing to the Ravid. Now, nowadays, it's pretty much well accepted in Orthodox Judaism that we believe that God doesn't have a body. Just, we should be aware that this wasn't always so simple. Now he continues and he says, "Ulam." He says, "Anachnu."
Then all these things, like the idea of Hashem has a body, isn't that so man can understand it? So putting on a simple level, so man can get the idea that Hashem is, you know, connected to Hashem in some way through thinking that he has a body.
Right. Well, that's how the Rambam explains why the Torah uses that kind of terminology. But there were those who disagreed and said the Torah uses that terminology because God indeed has a hand or a foot for a footstool, et cetera, et cetera. But you're right. That's how the Rambam and we as, you know, 20th century, 21st century Orthodox Jews, that's how we understand the Torah generally. That these are ways for us to understand an attribute of God, but not that he necessarily has a hand or that he has a hand at all. You're right, Ari. Now the Revolvi says, "Anachnu, we are rechokim mehasagat ruchniut merov heotenu regilim betfisa gashmit. We are so far away from understanding a world of ruchniut, of spiritual existence, because we are so deep into our materialist experience. Lachen kashelanu lahasig shavor elam ruchniut. So it's actually hard for us to understand what it means for God to be ruchni." That's what the entire first section of Mor Nebuchim is in the Rambam's work, Mor Nebuchim, is trying to understand why does the Torah use this kind of physical terminology. Now, here's the important part. He says, "Bizman shahaya yetzirah d'avodah zarah od kayam," when there was still a yetzir hara for avodah zarah. We'll get back to that in a second. "Haya zeni sayon gadol bishvil haklal yisrael shelo lahagshim et habore." When there was a strong inclination to serve Avodah Zarah, to be idolaters, that's when it was very difficult for Jews to not physicalize or anthropomorphize or make physical representations of God, because this was natural to them to take that spirituality and to make it physical. That was the most natural thing to them. Lachain hadibur hasheni. That's why the second Dibra, it's all about that. Keep in mind that you did not see any physical representation of God at Har Sinai. Because if you think that way, then you might come to create some kind of physical representation of God based on what you saw at Har Sinai. And he says, in fact, what happens right after Har Sinai? We know. Even though they didn't see anything, they still had a big nisayon to do it. Why? Because this was natural for them. Now I want to take a step back for 1 second. And he points out that this is when there was a yitzhara for Avodah Zarah. Y'all, why does he think there's no yitzhara for Avodah Zarah now?
Because there isn't Ezra or whoever.
I don't know if it was specifically Ezra, but yes, the Gemara in Yuma, and I think it's in Sanhedrin, tells the story that during the time of the Anshei Knesset HaGadol, they shechted, they slaughtered the Yetzirah for Avodah Zarah. It uses very vivid imagery, beautiful imagery, that there was a lion that came out of the Heichal, and they slaughtered the lion, and that was the Yetzer Hara for Avodah Zarah. And when they did that, They got rid of any inclination for Avodah Zarah for Jews, which is why we personally don't feel that inclination anymore. You know, nobody here, you know, Israeli Jews who take a trip after the army aside. I don't think that's why they take their trip to the East. But aside from them, you know, we don't feel such a strong pull. It's true that the truth is that there still is a Avodah Zarah in the world. It still exists in India and in Africa and places. But for the most part, this inclination has gone from the world. The Gemara actually continues and says that they tried to also abolish a little bit of the Yetzer Hara for Gilui Arayot. But they wanted to do it.
Even the chicken didn't even lay an egg.
Right, they tried it. They caged it. They caged the Yetzer Hara for Gilui Arayot. But the Gemara says that for 3 days, no chicken laid an egg. And it's clear the idea is that the Yetzer Hara for Gilui Arayot is necessary because it's what creates progress and ambition and passion and reproduction in the world. And so in the end, they decided not to. And in the end, they actually asked God if they could just, he could just kind of get rid of it. And it's a beautiful imagery, beautiful words. The Gemara says, "Apalga mishamayim lo yahavi." Heaven does not give halves. Shem doesn't do things in halves. So he couldn't get rid of the Yetzer Hara for Gilui Arayot. So in fact, actually, I should mention, and this is related to what Avolbi is going to talk about, the Gemara says that the Yetzer Hara for Avodah Zarah disappeared, right? Now, what ramifications does that have? Complete good? Is it only a good thing that the Yetzer Hara for Avodah Zarah is gone?
Doesn't it also mean that it seems that in ancient times it was obvious and clear to everybody that there was something, you know, that there were greater powers, the people that it was, they worshipped the sun, the moon, whatever, you know, but, and not having that Yetzer Hara means that there's a doubt about whether there's any kind of, you know, higher power.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. So none other than the Vilna Gaon says something very similar. He just says it in very technical terms. He says, just like the Yetzer Hara for Avodah Zarah went away, that's when Nevuah went away. That's when prophecy went away, because that awareness, like you said, Barbara, that awareness of something spiritual, something divine and higher, that was part of the Avodah Zarah experience. And it was also, lahavdil, frankly, part of the experience of Nevuah and of experiencing God.
I didn't hear that. Part of what?
It's part of the experience of being aware of God. It's all the same. We don't know, but I assume it's an overwhelming feeling that there are forces at work which we don't understand.
Yeah.
And that we're, you know, we're living in a world that isn't only physical. And since we no longer have that Yetzer Hara for Avodah Zarah, we also don't have the deep need and awareness of God to worship God.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a tragedy, but they went hand in hand. Apparently, Avodah Zarah was too much of a price to pay. And so now we have to create that desire and create that connection on our own without it being natural, right? If it was natural beforehand, now we have to create it. This is a term the Maharal uses. He says, everything is ze le'umat ze. Everything is corresponding. If God created a force for good, then he created a corresponding force for bad. And if you lose the good, then you have to lose the bad. And if you lose the bad, you have to lose the good. That's just the balance that the world has. Now Ravobi continues and he says, B'shirat ha'azinu, you see that it says, Yizbechu l'shedim lo alawak, Elohim lo yida'um, Chadashim mikarov ba'u, lo shi'arum avotechem. This last line, he says, these new things came from close that were not understood or evaluated by our fathers. He says, what does that mean? Me'akarov shalahem yavo elilim. Hainu mi'asviva shalahem. Meaning, every generation, he says, has new inclinations, new challenges, new nisyonot. And he says, where do they come from? He says, they come from the milieu, from the culture. It becomes in style to serve them. כמנהג כל אופנה הבאה מקרוב, ובני אדם מרגישים עצמם מוכרחים לעשות כמותה. כי הרגישו שאם לא יעשו כמוה, לא יחשבו עוד מודרניים. In every generation, something comes up in the culture, and everybody feels that, you know, this is what we have to do. Everybody does this. And if you don't do this, you're backwards. You're from the Stone Age. All modern people act this way or believe this way. And so he says, this is what the line means. Chadashim mikarov ba'o lo she'arum avoteichem. So if we don't have the inclination of Avodah Zarah, so he says, so what do we have? Kol ze b'yod yitzor d'Avodah Zarah v'takfo. Aval gam k'she bitlu yitzor d'Avodah Zarah lo nitpatel ela oto levush shel yitzor. La'avod pesel o eliyot. The yitzor itself, he says, still exists. Just the manifestation of it is different. The yitzor lovesh b'kol dor levush chadash. Every generation gets a new levush, like it says in Michta Meliyahu of Rav Dessler. So he says, the levush of Yitzhar Davar Zara of today is chomranut, is materialism. Shekol ador shakua b'nehira b'turefet acharei gashmiyut. Asher akein ha'azarot anal b'tokfan gam ayom b'nyanei hafraza b'gashmiyut. The same way that Hashem said to Moshe Rabbeinu, don't serve me by creating idols, Gashmi idols, because that's what you're going to want to do. Now it's don't become, completely engrossed in the chomraniyut. So she yishkehu kol kach begashmiyut ad shenishkecha legamri mitziyuta shel ruchniyut v'yishkehu ota borei ki ruchniyut tichaver le'umat ha'afraza begashmiyut. If the original generation, if the earlier generations, their problem was that they were going to try to serve God by encasing him in gold, and then serving that gold, our problem is that we fail to serve God because we get lost in our gold and we forget about God completely. Now he quotes a beautiful line of Yerushalmi. I never saw this Yerushalmi before. I saw it inside over here. It says, "Kirvatenu l'gashmiut mizeh v'harichuk shalanu miruchniut mi'idach." We have a closeness to gashmiut and a distance, and we're far from ruchniut. It says, "Chazal marim lanu et ha-paradox shebedavar." They show us the paradox. Gemara says in Yerushalmi, "Chazu v'shalu haminim oto ma ahan dechtiv migoy gadol asher elokim korbim ilav." So they asked. I think this is Rav Yochanan. I can't remember exactly, but I think it's Rav Yochanan. They said they asked Rav Yochanan, "How do you understand the pasuk that says migoy gadol asher elokim korbim ilav? What's the problem with this pasuk?"
It's in plural.
Which word is in plural?
Korvim elokim.
Elohim Korvim. Yeah, it sounds like there's multiple gods. Who is this Goy Gadol, this great nation, to whom the gods are close to? That's a problem, right? So Amar Lehen, Kashem Elokeinu b'kol Koreinu Elehem in Ktiv, Ele b'kol Koreinu Elav, says Koreinu means we call out to him. So he says, you understand, Elohim Korvim, Elohim will leave alone. But krovim means that each person, it's talking about the people. Elokim krovim elav. It's talking about the people being close to God. So it's multiple, the plural is the people. So this apparently appeased the minim, the heretics, but the talmidim didn't like it. Amru lo talmidav le'elu dachita v'kaneh, lanu ma ata mashiv. This is actually a common occurrence in Chazal, where a heretic comes to a rabbi, asks a question, the rabbi answers the question, the heretic goes away, but the students respond and say to the rabbi, you know, that wasn't very convincing. What are you going to say to us? He said, you pushed him away with a reed, with a weak reed. But what are you going to say to us? How do you explain this? So look at this line. He says, Amar lehen, karov b'kol minei krivut. He is close to us in all manner of ways of being close. So Asher Elokim Krovim Elav, Krovim means in many different ways is he Karov.
You might ask, why didn't he just say this to the questioner to begin with?
Yeah, he didn't want to bother. He didn't want to teach him the deepest stuff. Damar of Pinchas B'Shem Rebar Simon, Al Zeh Nireit, Avodah Zarah, look at this line. Avodah Zarah Nireit Krova Ve'eina Ela Rechoka. Avodah Zarah looks close, but it's really far. Why? Matama, Yisa'u al katef, Yisbeluhu, Sof davar Eloho imo babait, Behut so'ek, Ad sheyamut, V'lo yishma v'lo yoshe mitarato. A person can carry around his idol on his shoulder, in his pocket. He can carry it around, you know, by his chest. He can place it in his house and stand in front of it or kneel in front of it and pray and pray and pray until he dies. And it's as close to him as anything can be. It'd be right in front of his face, but it will never respond because it's not real. But God, he seems to be as far as he can be, but the truth is, there is nothing closer than him. Says the distance between us and then the next, and the celestial bodies is 500 amos, and then the next one is 500 amos. God is thousands and thousands and millions of light years away from us. That's what he says. However, they make him even further and further and further. But a person comes into shul, he stands in his spot, a chazan stands in his spot, and he prays in a whisper so that nobody else can hear him. But God hears him. Shneemar, v'chana hi medaberet aliba, rak sfateh naot v'kola lo yishama, v'hazina kadosh baruch hu tfilata. That Chana taught us how to pray. She was, her lips were moving, but no sound was coming out. And that's why Eli actually accused her of being drunk, because it looked like she was talking to herself, but the truth is she wasn't talking to herself. She was talking to God, and God heard her. V'chen b'rotav shneemar tfilala ani ki atof. It's like a person is talking into another person's ear. And then he hears. It says God is as close to us as from a mouth to a person's ear. But these lines are just gold. He says, Avodah Zarah is, it looks karov, but it's really rachok. And God is looks rachok, but he's really karov. That's his line over here. And I wrote a note to myself on the bottom over here. Ravobi writes in Alei Shur, I think I said this a few years ago on Rosh Hashanah. I got good feedback that this was a very meaningful thing. Ravobi says, this is from Alei Shur. Alei Shur, not Alei Shur. Alei Shur. So Ravobi says, it's part of a larger piece over here, but he says, Im me'olam lo izdazata l'mashmaut ha'davar shakadosh baruch hu omer elecha anochi v'im me'olam lo izdazata kishamarte elav itbarach ata hari me'olam lo amadeta lifnei konecha ubarecha. If you never trembled at the idea that God, when he speaks to us, he says anochi, I, because he's standing right in front of us, or that when we speak to him or we make a bracha, we say baruch Ata. Ata is second person. That's a person, that's like you're standing right in front of them. You say, Baruch Ata. If you just think about that fact, that when you say a bracha, it's like you're talking directly to God. He says, if you've never thought about that, then you've never realized that you're standing in front of Hashem. Right? That's how close he is. He says, Arei avodah zarah kovah rechaka. Avodah Zarah is close because it's physical. You can touch it. You can literally touch it. On the other hand, it has no essence. It's not real. Luxus, I think, is a luxury. It's just like the Avodah Zarah of old. We build our lives with all kinds of, all manners of luxury, which are easy to touch, easy to feel, easy to experience, but on the other hand, completely empty. You know, you can have a beautiful car, and if it gets you from point A to point B, then it's useful. But aside from that, the beauty doesn't do anything. It has no pnimiut.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, Barry.
Sorry. When you were saying before about Hashem being close, yes? He seems to be far, but he's actually very close. So what about this idea of in Elul, you know, the king is in the field. So it suggests right. that he's far the rest of the year, but in Elul, he's close.
Yeah, I mean, the metaphor, I will admit, the metaphor is difficult, right? A melech basadeh is a difficult metaphor because you're right, it seems like he's not close. But yes, in Judaism, we apparently believe that there are times that are misugal, just like there are places that are misugal. You could ask the same question about the Beit HaMikdash, right? Mm-hmm. What makes the Beit HaMikdash special? Apparently his presence is more intensely felt there. Or perhaps we might say, it is a time that... It is a place, let's talk about the Beit HaMikdash, it is a place where it is easier to experience God's presence. So to Elul is a time when it's easier to experience God's presence, perhaps because it's in close proximity to the point in time when he created the world. And so it makes sense that we should be thinking about him much more during this time. I admit, you know, if you take the mashal at face value, does God really come closer to the world in Elul than he is the rest of the year? Maybe not, I'm not sure. But certainly it can at least mean that our experience of him is much easier to have during Elul.
Thank you.
So he continues and he says, Al-Kadosh Baruch Hu Amru Shehu Karov B'Kol Minei Kirva. Ava Meidach Hu Rechok V'Tzarech Lahavin Ketzad Mitarim Chazal At HaRichuk HaBoreh Meitanu Ba'Alfei Shanim. Why do Chazal talk about God as being very distant, as being very, very far away? After all, he fills everything. What are Chazal describing here? They're describing exactly this point, that our experience of him as being Ruchni makes him feel distant from us. That's what Chazal are describing. Our inability to comprehend him and to feel him in a physical way, that makes him distant. In other words, you might as well just say he's infinitely far away because we'll never be able to really, really physically feel him sensually. And in that sense, he couldn't be more distant. Let's get past this part. He's just describing how Chazal, when they use large numbers, it's really a guzma. It's a poetic license. They're just placeholders. The 500 here doesn't denote anything, any 500-ness. It just means very, very far. But he says, Omnam richuk HaKadosh Baruch Hu mitfisateinu hagashmit rav mod. It's true that his distance from us feels very, very large because we have no gashmiut over here. Until we can't even imagine it. However, he says, and this is why, by the way, the Torah uses terms like eye of God or the ears of God or the finger of God, because it's trying to make it easier for us, right, to understand and to relate to God. But he says, we do have to acknowledge that God is not made out of a body, so that we don't chas v'shalom come to think that. But after we realize that, once we realize and we acknowledge and we accept the idea that God doesn't have a body and therefore we're infinitely distant from him, we still have to know because of his lack of a body, and because of his complete otherness, that allows him to become closer to us. How does that work? So this is the deep understanding of what Rabbi Yochanan, I think it's Rabbi Yochanan, is teaching his students. Because even though he has no, if he would have a body, as we kind of rolled our eyes at the beginning when the Rambam says that he's God up above and he's God below, and that's a proof that he has no body because how could he be both above and below? So the depth over there, though, is that because he has no body and because he's completely Ruchni, he's able to be quote-unquote everywhere all at once, which means he's able to be close to everyone all at once.
It seems to me that if we were to accept that God has a physical body, someone would come up with an image and say, this is what God looks like.
Right.
And we would all be carrying around a little statue of what we think God looks like.
Of course. That's what we would do. And then we would be able to hold it, and we'd be able to talk to it, and that would be it. And then what would happen if you lost it?
Go buy another one.
Or what happens if somebody has a nicer one than yours? Or, you know, or just the absurdity of it, that we would believe that this object really would represent. Because, I mean, Dad, what you're pointing out is, you know, it's not totally a bizarre, because if you were to have an object like that, you wouldn't be saying that this is God. You'd just be saying God looks like this, right? Which is different.
Yes, yes.
But nevertheless, you would eventually come to probably treat it as if it was God. But let's get off of that. The point that he's making, though, is that specifically God...
Because then you start doing a lot, you know, you start, like, you... Bad things happen to you, you start shouting at it, you start getting angry at it, good things happen to you, you say thank you. It's a dangerous path to go down to have such an object.
Right. Although it would be very cathartic, I imagine. So his ultimate point over here, though, is that God's distance is really his closeness, in a way. Because by not having a body, it allows God to be everywhere and in everything, and allow us to relate to him not only through the good, but also through the bad, not only in certain times, but in all times, not only in some places, but in all places. And in that way, he's karov b'kol mine kirva. He's close to us, closer than anything could possibly be. And that's why I use the plural of krovim instead of karov. Now, the next section I want to skip over, he talks about Yitro and Moshe Rabbeinu, just a little bit of parshanut.
Can you just talk that through again about how does that work that therefore it's Krovim rather than Karov? It seems you made a jump there. At least I didn't follow that.
Right. So this is really, I don't know if you were here from the beginning, but this was a
quote. Yeah, I've been here from the beginning.
Oh, okay, good.
Yes,
so we had this pasuk over here of Migoy Gadol Asher Elokim Krovim Elav. Yep. So it should have said Migoy Gadol Asher Elokim Karov Elav, right?
Yep.
So he says Karov wouldn't cover it, because then it's Karov in the same way that, you know, you're Karov to a car or Karov to a piece of furniture. No, he's Krovim. He's you know, even more than Karov. He's Krovim. He's Bekol Mine Korva. He's super karov. Nothing could be closer to. He's close to you in every direction. From every direction you could possibly go in, he's close.
Isn't there some concept of imminent?
Yeah.
You know, Hashem is imminent and transcendent. Doesn't imminent mean...
That's a common phrase. Imminence and transcendence. It refers to the way that we relate to God in the Kiddusha, right? You have Kadosh, 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 Hashem. That's the transcendence, that he's kadosh, kadosh, kadosh. He's far, he's far, he's far. But then on the other end is his malokal aretz kvodo, right? Which is his imminence, which means that he fills the world. And there's this tension that we talk about, you know, specifically during the Yamim Noraim of ratzo vashov, of coming closer and going farther, because we feel, you know, that God is both imminent and transcendent. He's close, but then he's far. We feel close to him, but we know that we'll never be close to him, right? And that's kind of what he's relating to over here. You're right. Ravolbi is putting his finger on that paradox of God, that he's on the one hand karov and on the other rachok, and there's nothing we can do about it. In fact, not only is there nothing you can do about it, but the more karov you get to God, the more rachok you realize he is. One of my favorite pieces in the Nitivot Shalom, in the Slonim Rebbe, is he talks about the difference between the anava, the humility of Aaron HaKohen and Moshe Rabbeinu. Because both of them are described as being ultimately humble. He says, how can they both be humble? They're totally different from each other. So he says they're humble in two different ways. Aaron is humble Because Aaron is comparing himself to what he could be. Aaron realizes that there is a, you know, a paradigmatic ultimate Aaron that he should be aspiring to. And he realizes that at the same time he's not there. And that makes him be humble because he realizes, you know what, I'm not so special because I could be even greater. But Moshe Rabbeinu, that's not his humility. Because Moshe Rabbeinu realizes, or I don't know if he realizes, but he is the best he could be. So what makes Moshe Rabbeinu humble? Because Moshe Rabbeinu is the closest to God that anybody could possibly be. But because he's the closest to God that anybody could possibly be, that only makes him understand and realize how much greater God is than he is. The closer you get, the better a picture of the yardstick you get between us and God, the more you realize how big that yardstick is. The most arrogant person is the person who believes that he is just like God, because he doesn't understand that the difference between him and God is so vast that there's nothing to be arrogant about. And so too over here, I think the idea is that the closer you get to God, the more you realize that he's distant. But at least that understanding actually brings you closer to him.
Great. Another thought about Avinu Malkeinu, you know, this same similar kind of idea.
Right, well, I think is referring to Din and Rachamim, right? That's a different paradox, I think, of God's strictness and justice, and on the other hand, his compassion and love and chesed, which are also...
Christmas and distance, yeah, okay.
Maybe you could connect them, but it doesn't seem off the bat to be connected. He points out, the point over here is that he points out that Yitro, okay, we have a parsha named after Yitro. And Yitro, we know that he came from Avodah Zarah, but then he eventually came to acknowledge God. And yet, even Yitro, who came to acknowledge God, what phrase does he use? He says, here we go, Ki Hashem hu Elokim. Where is it? Here. Atayadati. This is what Yitro says. Atayadati, now I know, ki gadol Hashem mikol ha'elokim. But there's a flaw there, no? What did Yitro say?
There's other gods.
Exactly. So he says, Yitro ha'adam ha'gadol shehitkayer v'yiter parsha achat b'torah v'chivev et ha'torah. This is Yitro that we're talking about. Sof Natan Mamash Avodah Zarah, he still nevertheless gave some kind of substance to Avodah Zarah as if it's real. He says, Mizeh anachnu lomdim, kama kashehu la'adam l'hakir ha'gvulim bein ruchniut tohora u'bein gashmiut daka. Says, this just shows you how difficult it is to thread the needle, to walk the line between ruchniut and gashmiut. Because even Yitro couldn't understand God's complete ruchniut and the lack of any significance to Avodah Zarah at all. Okay. The next chapter is called Tavati B'Yavan Metula. Let me just see how long it is, whether there's something that we could do, we could start tonight. Here, you know, let's just start it. I don't know how far we're going to go, but we'll just start it. He says, so this is Parshat Ki Tetzeh. This is last week's Parsha. Nita'er la'atzmeinu adam hugla l'machane kfiya b'sibir l'shanim rabot v'holit sham yelet. Imagine a person got exiled to Siberia and he has a child. V'yelet gadel v'sham v'haya l'ish, and the child grows up there. Yelet zeh choshev ki chayei ha'machane hazeh hem hem chayei matkinim. That kind of child will believe that life in a labor camp in frozen Siberia, that's normal. That's normal life. The thing that makes him happy is when he has a day where the work is not too hard, right? Where he only has to, I don't know, when he only has to cut down 5 trees instead of 20. Or when they give him a little piece of bread, right? He doesn't complain. He doesn't complain about not having a TV or about not getting a steak dinner because he can't even imagine it. Doesn't even know it's an option. Aviv, but his father, Shara'a Chaim Achaim, Vulaya Apam Ba'olam HaMa'aravi, Hu Yodea Sheyesh Na'olam Chofshi. He knows that there is such a world. There's a big difference between the father and the son. The father actually knows, he remembers a different world. David says, this is a phrase that Israelis have adopted, which means that, you know, I've had too much. The water is getting up to my mouth. I'm not going to be able to breathe soon. I've drowned in this materialism. I should have looked this up. I don't know how to pronounce all these words. I'm struggling and I'm choking. That's what David says. He's going to drown. He feels like he's drowning in a lack of ruchniut. So David HaMelech is complaining that his life is so completely filled with gashmiut that he misses the ruchniut. But he knows that it's supposed to exist. Now, I'll skip past this part. He says, our existence. Anachnu einenu tzoakim. We're not like David. We don't scream. We don't even feel like we're drowning in the mud. Ki anachnu domim layelet shekvar nolad b'machane kfiya b'sibir. We're the child. We're the child who grew up in the Machane Sibir, in the Siberian camp, because we don't know what it's supposed to be. We can't imagine another existence, another reality, where there's anything besides for what we see, feel, hear, taste, and experience.
When did this Rabbi Volbi live?
Volbi? He died, yes. He died about a decade ago.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was just wondering about the references to Siberia, that's why.
Yeah, he lived through World War II, but he wasn't in Germany. We talked about it last time, he was in Sweden. He was saved from the war. He was in Sweden during the war. Yeah. He quotes the Chazal that says that when Adam Arishon sinned, so the Shekhinah, God's presence, so Barbara, this is, you know, getting back to what you were talking about before, about God's presence. God's presence retreated up one rakia, I don't know what the word for rakia is, one plane of existence. And then when Dor Enosh came, when Cain sinned, it went up another one, and then another one, another one, and it went to the seventh rakia, which is the final one. And then when Avram came, it came down one, and when Yisrael came, it came down another, and then eventually it returned to the earth when Moshe Rabbeinu built the Mishkan. So there is this sense that you can actually feel God's presence in the world to varying degrees. And now we're in a matzav shel Elokim rachok v'karov. Because, you know, we don't have the Mishkan anymore. Skip past this. I think we're going to stop over here and we'll pick up from here next time. All right. It's already 10:50. And some of you have had too much to drink. But I hope it was fun.
Not me.
Not me. Barbara, I saw your comment on WhatsApp. So Kulaka votes for staying awake.
That's right.
What did I say on WhatsApp? Oh, right. Yeah, okay. Yeah.